Two.
Blinking, right?
Hi, tonight is March 4th, 2017. This is the last lecture for this season, the sixth season. We called it the 1300s. This is the last season of the 1300s. Next season, I guess we're going to start with the, 1400s, but it's going to be a whole new world. And this really, after what we've seen, what we've been through, what we've discussed, really the world, Europe at least for sure, was totally different. What I thought I would do tonight is just like just a little bit of a review of what we've been through. Mainly what I have done is we've done different various countries and we took the countries through the 1300s. So that's what I thought we would just do, just to get summarize and realize where the Jewish people are, what's doing with the Jewish people at the end of the 1300s, what's a little bit doing with the countries if we would mention. So the first country I thought we would go to would be the England. So, well, I think we're going to see a sort of a pattern, and the pattern is going to be is that the Jews will come into a country, they'll be welcomed in, they'll be asked to join, there'll be a time of growth, a time of prosperity, and then there'll be while the Jews are being very successful, then there's going to be some anti-Semitism, things that are going to happen against the Jews. And then at some point in every one of these countries, the usefulness of the Jew is going to be used up. The hatred that was building is going to be come out, and the Jews are going to be exiled or sent out. And that's basically a pattern. And we're going to see this pattern in about four different countries here. So let's start with the English Jewry. The Jews really were about 200 years total in England. They were exiled and then they were again let back in the 1600s. But that's going to be much later for us. Really, the king that started it was William the First, otherwise known as William the Conqueror. Jews came in with William the Conqueror, by Edward the First, that's when they were going to be exiled. Just a little bit, the king that really, really brought in Jews and felt that he needed Jews was after William, it was King Henry the First, and he invaded. He basically wanted to become king. His brother was king, and for whatever reason, he became king, but he was the one that realized he was a strong king, a strong monarch, knew how to take care of a country, build a country. He had plenty of things, natural resources. He had an army. He had loyalty. He had good government. The only thing he was missing was a middle class. He needed money. He needed things to get business going, and that's where the Jews came in. He invited the Jews, and the Jews came in. He promoted the Jewish immigration. He actually came up with a charter for the Jews. This is also one of the first or only charters that a government had. He granted Jews permitted to move around the country, buy and sell goods, sell their pledges after holding a year, and to be tried by their peers. Again, the charter was something to be very to want Jews to be able to come. It was a positive in a time of error that Jews didn't have rights, or rights of Jews were limited. Or so when you give Jews this type of freedom, you're encouraging them to come. You're making business like a business friendly climate a possibility for the Jews to make money. And the king knew that if the Jews are making money, that means the government, or the king, will make money, because he taxes the Jews. The Jews would be taxed at a different rate, a much higher rate, but that is long as everybody's making money, it's that's fine. That works out very nicely. King Henry still he fined Jews. He wasn't beyond, you know, fining Jews for no reason. It was a time where there was a doctor had to deal with a patient, and the patient died. Probably was mortally sick before he came to the Jewish doctor, but he died under the Jewish doctor's hands, and he fined £2,000. This would be in about $2 million today. It was just but it was more of an excuse. Sometimes when they fine Jews, it's in order, not that they ask them for the money, but they annul debts that have been about, oh, you owe us now £2,000. Listen, why don't we just, you know, £1,000 that were £1,500 that we owe you, that's it, we don't owe you anymore. You can't do that too often. And if you do it too often, you won't have Jews, you won't have money. And that's really what's going to happen towards the end under King Henry III and Edward I, is that they just wanted to take all the money that they can from the Jews, and they were penniless and poor, and now you had no purpose for them. Then came King Stephen. So after King Stephen wasn't well-liked. I figured during King Stephen, Stephen? I'm not sure. It could be that it's...
After King Henry, I think there was King Richard.
Huh?
After King Henry, there was King Richard.
No. Richard is going to be later. There's a Henry II, then came Richard.
Oh, okay.
There's a Henry I. There was Stephen, John,
yeah,
and then...
John.
So I guess we can just go back and just... So first was William II, Henry killed his brother William, then came Stephen, Henry II, then came Richard. Right. Okay, so when King Stephen, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. So one thing was that happened during his reign, very significant, which would impact the Jewish community till our day. I mean, in the 1900s, there was a blood libel in Rochester, New York, or somewhere in New York, upstate New York, even to today. And how many tens of thousands of Jews had been killed, how many, maybe even hundred thousands of Jews throughout the next 900 years, how many Jews had been expelled, all because of this blood libel. And we mentioned, we brought it, that the first blood libel happened to have been in Norwich, in England. And just crazy things. The Jews need the blood for the Pesach, or they have this whole thing. They have to kill. Just ridiculous. It's not the time to go into it again. But the first one was in England, 1144 under Stephen. Now, however, just for Stephen, just something very just that he did is during this 1144 was really during the time of the Second Crusade. So even at times when the Jews would have been at the mercy of the Crusades, and mind you, the Second Crusade was not as bad as the First Crusade. The First Crusade for the Jewish people was the worst. We'll speak about that a little more when we get to Germany. But the Second Crusade was bad, but not as bad. And in England, King Stephen made sure that nothing happened to the Jews in England during the time of the Second Crusade, which is the armies gathering to go to Eretz Yisrael to fight the Muslims. Okay, so that was it. Now, then after Stephen came King Henry II. Under King Henry II was probably the zenith, the best for the Jews. That's the time when the Jews were the most wealthiest, the most established. Things were working well. Things were going well. The Jews felt very comfortable in the land, and they were doing very, very well. They were helping the country grow, and it almost like they were becoming too comfortable. They were becoming too comfortable, and that's always their downfall. We're just going through. I figured this week we just do a review of where we were, where we got to. The first country we spoke about is England, We're now during the time of Henry II, and Henry II was the at the time, this was the best time for the Jews. The indication of it was that in England at the time there was a person by the name of Aaron of Lincoln, and Aaron of Lincoln was wealthy beyond comparison, beyond belief. I don't know if he was wealthier than the king, but the fact that he was so wealthy, it says over here he exceeded the king. Also, he had his own coat of armor. He maintained agents in 17 of the 25 counties in England. By the time he died in 1186, he was the richest man in Britain. And upon his death, Henry said, "Why have an opportunity go to waste?" I guess this is the first, what do they call it, the inheritance tax today. Maybe they learned it from Henry II, but he seized all of Aaron of Lincoln's property. It took him then, got two exchequers, or whatever they call it, two people on the pipe rolls, full-time people, when all their job was to get all of Aaron of Lincoln's money. And he lent to everybody. He built, I think he was responsible for building at least the first time Westminster Abbey, plus many other churches and big buildings, financing projects. There was counts and priests, and just so many people just owed him money. And after 25 years, they still couldn't collect it all. And I think the king at the time just wrote it off as a loss. Because
he
was an accountant.
Tzedakah?
Huh?
Did he give tzedakah?
I'm sure he did. I'm sure. I mean, just the amount of money and wealth. And this is all under Henry II. Again, during this era also, things were on good terms. If there was a commotion, if things were going bad, the Jews actually took refuge in the abbeys. These are the Christian churches. These are among the Christians in the monasteries, and they knew that they were safe there. To such a point, that's what was going on between the Jews and the Christians. Maybe they shouldn't have lahalacha. Maybe they felt too close to their Christian neighbors, but that was the. And that could have been their down their undoing, at least, you know, Klapi Shmaya. But they lived in opulent houses, and eventually what happened is, you know, when they portray themselves in a certain way, so then they start to get the hatred or the jealousy of the Goyim around them. And that's, after this term, things are going to start going downhill. In the latter part of Henry's reign, anti-Jewish sentiment spread throughout throughout the nation. Afterwards, and we see it already with the beginning of Richard the Lionhearted. Richard the Lionhearted had his big coronation. Again, Richard the Lionhearted, in his 12 years of being king, I think he was in England maybe a total of 6 months. He hated England. He didn't even speak English. He only spoke French, King of England. But he was an adventurer. He loved wars and fighting, and that's all his life he did. He actually led a crusade into the Third Crusade. He led into against the Muslims, and with mixed results. Probably you would put it down as a loss, as a waste. But and then he came back, he always felt insecure about England. So I think he was coronated a few times, but he had one major coronation in England, and that led to commotion, riots against the Jews. Now again, Richard got it. He understood what to use Jews for. He understood, he being a man of war and always doing war, he needed lots of money. Maintaining armies, very expensive. And he knew that Jews would bring in money. And during his coronation, this is all probably what he did not know at the time, but this coronation was taking place in, I think it was in Westminster Abbey, yeah. And some Jews were outside, and they wanted to bring a gift to the king. And they were not allowed in. So at some point there was like a distraction, and some Jews actually snuck in. Well, they snuck in, they were caught, and they were beaten and thrown out. And when that happened, so people thought that Richard approved of this. So then they started beating up and rioting on more Jews. And then throughout London they were going, and they were rioting. When Richard found out about this, he was extremely upset. He put out an edict, a proclamation, whatever, saying the Jews are not to be touched and they're not to be hurt, disturbed, damaged, or whatever. That worked while he was there, but he wasn't there too often. He just went back to France. That's where he liked to most of his time, if he wasn't going on adventurous wars. What then happened, this led to riots all over the country, which also led to the most, this is the riots in London first, and so he got wind of it, and that day, the next day, he put out proclamations to stop it. But eventually it spread, and it spread to different areas. York is much, much more north. And they said when this happened, so I guess it was like a tinderbox, the guy him getting jealous of the Jews. He also owed the Jews a lot of money. In York, after they killed the Jews, they stormed the church where the Jews kept the records, and they burnt it all. And I guess that could have been some of the reason for the motivation of killing these Jews. So, but York was a terrible tragedy. The 150 Jews were killed, and they were just totally massacred. We, we mentioned in our Tisha B'Av kinnis, we make a mention. We mention about this terrible tragedy. And since then, things were just basically on the down. This is 1190. This is where they were hidden up in Clifford Tower in York. Afterwards came King John, Richard's youngest brother. From the histories, it seems that he was not a nice person. He was like a mean, didn't get it. He got into fights with everybody, including all the other not knights, but all the other
barons
and everything. He just didn't was not. And he also he was very cruel also to the Jews. Took a lot of money from them. The incident we did with Avram of Bristol, he had to make a special tax, and he didn't want to pay it. So basically, they pulled a tooth out every day until he agreed to pay. After 7 teeth, finally, him or whoever it was, they got the money together to pay it. But that was under John, and only got worse. Oh, during his time also, 300 rabbis, they moved to Akko. Tosafos, 300 Tosafos moved to Akko at about 1211, and this is all under right after the Third Crusades. Things were happening between the Christians and the Church. Actually, the Christians had just conquered, through Richard the Lionhearted, they did manage to conquer Akko, and these 300 Bali Tosafos with their relatives, with their families, they moved to Akko. That also happened under John. And then came Henry III of England. So he also was very harsh on the Jews, taxed them, took a lot of their money. He considered, more so than the others, he considered the Jews his private property. He belonged to the king. It was a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, nobody would dare attack the Jews. I shouldn't say it like that, but it was people would be afraid to attack the Jews because they... the king's property. Would you go ahead and take the king's house and vandalize the king's house? He wouldn't do such a thing because it's the king. So too, he viewed the Jews as his personal property. So it saved the Jews, but yet on the other hand, he felt that he could take all the money, as much money away from them as possible. And that's in 1272. 1229, another 8,000 mark talage. 1232, another 10,000. 1253, he ordered that the shuls have to daven quietly, so the Christians should not have to hear the what's going on outside. And then came Edward. That's it. It's over by Edward. Edward became king when he was very young, and I guess his priests that helped him grow up, and his mother, who also gave him a very anti-Semitic bent towards the Jews. And eventually he taxed him out of money in between 1219 and 1272. That's about 50 years. There were 49 levies, a total of 200,000 marks. We met in 1275, the Statute of the Jews, outlawing any, the Jews cannot lend at interest. So like, that's the whole purpose, that's how they made their money. The Jews lent with interest, and you're outlawing it. So the Jews found heterim, you know, the prisbles, you know, were partners. So they got around a lot of the technicalities. But once that happened, they're not interested in the Jews in terms of their usefulness of lending money and keeping business going. So that's it. So they outlawed their taxes. By 1290, that's it. He was pressured to expel the Jews. By November 4th, about 4,000 Jews had already left. The Jewish community in England was never very, very large. I don't know if it ever exceeded like 10,000 Jews at that point. I mean, I guess maybe for the Middle Ages it was large, but nothing like in Spain. We're talking hundreds of thousands of Jews. Just it was a bit relatively small. November 1st, it was things where they saw the writing on the wall. About 4,000 Jews had left, only to France. But that's not going to help them because in 1306 they're going to be expelled from France, and they were allowed to leave with their stuff. Here, just the between 2,000 and 4,000 Jews ended up. That's it. They had to leave. The British, I guess they didn't learn. They didn't know from the next expulsion that you can just send them out without their money. So they allowed the Jews to leave with their movable items. They lost their houses and fields. If they could have sold them, I'm sure they did. But they were able to leave with their items, and they were told the Jews cannot be harmed on their way out. And just they did bring an incident where some boat captain just told them the tide was low and told them to take a little bit of a walk, get off the boat, and when we're ready to leave, we'll call you. And when the tide came in, the captain did not let him on the boat, left, and these Jews drowned. So, but they were punished later on in England after this. The Jews emigrated to Scotland, France, Netherlands, and to Poland. And that's pretty much it for the Jews. 1291, that's it. The England is free. There's no more Jews in England. So now let's just go to France. Just any questions about England?
Yeah. I have a question about Scotland.
Huh?
I have a question about Scotland. Was there any Scottish Jewish community?
I think there was, nothing large, but they were also expelled. I have it later on, and I don't know if it's Scotland or Ireland, also about the same time, shortly after. Mm. All right, France. So France, just again, it's pretty much the same thing in terms of the amount that they were there. From about 800, from Charlemagne, he was the one that actually brought Jews in. From 800 till about the First Crusade, till about 1090, Jews were doing very well there, and that was the time, you know, and then after 1090, even after 1090, it was still okay. The Crusades mainly affected Germany, not France, at least the first one. But after the Crusades, things started going downhill. So the first like 200 years, the Jews were doing fine. They were getting along with the non-Jewish neighbors, and then slowly but surely, it just started going downhill. Charlemagne, he was the one. He united the entire mainland of Europe. Everything, all of what was today France, Germany, all the way into Italy. And Charlemagne, he had it all. In 800, he saved the Pope and from an attack, and the Pope was grateful to him, and the Pope coronated him as the Emperor of Europe, of Germany, the Emperor emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor. That's was and that was his title, and that was and he welcomed Jews. He realized also he needed Jews for his for business to go, and Jews came and they were welcomed. We mentioned from Italy they came a family, and the Jews were just from there and they were growing and what eventually happened with his grandchildren, he had a son, Charles, and then his grandchildren, there were three grandchildren. He had three grandchildren, three sons of Charles. And three of them, I guess they didn't realize that, like in most times, that one of them should kill the other two and keep the entire empire to themselves. But so they ended up dividing the country into three parts. One part eventually became France, one part, the other west, the eastern part eventually became Germany, and the part in the middle eventually became like different areas, eventually also swallowed up by France and Germany, but there were other countries, I think that's around where Belgium would be, and Switzerland, and that's where that area would be. So on the France side, the German side, that had the yeshivas, that was the Rhineland, that had Rabbeinu Gershom. But if in the yeshiva of the German yeshivas, eventually there was a person by the name of Rashi, and after learning in the yeshiva many years, he came and he lived in France, and then that came the beginning, the line of Rashi with the Bali Tosfos. This is where it all started in France. Again, Rashi, the end of his life was the First Crusade. The First Crusade did not affect France Jewry very minimally. Because the First Crusade was really two parts. It was the People's Crusade and the Knights. So even though the Knights had come from France as well, but the Crusade that was killing the Jews were the People's Crusade that started in Germany and was going east. It was going east. So already France was west of them. So most of France was not affected as much as Germany, and by this crusade, when they got to Hungary, the king of Hungary had enough and just killed them all. So the People's Crusade were pretty much all wiped out. Never made it to the Holy Land. What did make it was the Knights Crusade. That was organized. That's that they had. They called ahead. They had lodging, as opposed to the People's Crusade were mobs. They just went from city to city to city. If there were Jews, they just killed them all and took all their money. There were no Jews, and they just pillaged the people that were there until they were killed out. Anyway, so we have Rashi and the Bali Tosfos. This is all in France. Rashi again was from 1040 to 1105. The Rivan, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashbam. If anybody's doing Daf Yomi, now we're in Baba Basra. So the Rashbam is in the Gemara. Rashi only has for the first 29 dafin, and afterwards the rest of Baba Basra is the Rashbam, the Ri, and then it just goes on. Most of the Bali Tosfos were related with descendants of Rashi. Just moving right along, just the major event that was in France, and you could see the beginning of the end in France, is in 1236. A person by the Nicholas Donan, he was a apostate Jew. He came to the Pope and claimed that he could refute the Talmud. The Talmud is what's keeping the Jews against Christianity, and he could show that the Talmud was wrong. So what the Pope did, he sent out to all of the countries, confiscate all the Talmuds. And the only country that complied was France under King Louis the Ninth. I'm not sure which Louis it was. Anyway, so they had a debate, and it wasn't really a fair debate. The Christians already decided that the Jewish religion was wrong, and after the debate, they basically took the 24 cartloads of Sfarim, and they burnt it all. And this was, again, this is about 200 years before the printing press. So every one of those volumes was handwritten. I'm sure there were works that were totally lost. There were no more Gemaras to be found. And this was like the beginning of the end for French Jewry. There was no more Sfarim. And from France, they started moving eastward to Germany. There were always Jews there, even at this time. But in 1306, King Philip, short of money, what do? Expel your Jews. So he was able to keep it a... Was this the one he was able to keep a secret? In 1306, he expelled all his Jews. This was really only in the north of France, because Provence, which was south France, was really owned by the Pope. The Pope owned the Provence region. So the Jews were basically able to stay there. But in the north France, that's it. Jews were thrown out in 1306. However, in 1315, when King Louis, Louis came, he allowed the Jews to come back in. I guess he needed more money. So he allowed the Jews to come back in. The Jews came back in. And for the next few hundred years, we're going to have the Hundred Years' War. But basically, it's going to end 1322. They were banished again. But it's all going to be in 1394. That is, they give as the last final, that's it. Jews out in 1394, 1391, I'm not sure. But that's it. Jews are out in 1394, and they're not coming back again for another few hundred years. So now, at the end of the 1300s, no more Jews in France. And throughout the 1300s, the Jews are thrown out of France. They're let back in. France conquers a little different area where there are Jews, so they have more Jews, and they let them back in, they let them back out. But for the next 100 years, the Jews are, that's it. Were there so many Jews in France during that time? Probably not. Once you start throwing Jews out and having them come back and back and forth, so instability, Jews don't do well, and they don't go to such places. So now, by the end of the 1300s, you have no more Jews in England and no more Jews in France. And then we move to Spain. So in Spain, where did it all start again? It all started with Abd al-Rahman III, if I'm saying his name correctly. And he came in the 10th century, 912 to 961. And he wanted Spain, his country, to be cutting edge of civilization. And he did a great job. He really did. He encouraged all types of learning and education. He invited scholars, scientists, philosophers, poets, everything to come to Cordoba. And he really did. Cordoba is in the south of Spain. He also had a physician, diplomat, Khazda ibn Shaprut. And Khazda ibn Shaprut was very instrumental in supporting the Jewish community and building up Torah. I don't have a slide here, but I should have mentioned, then came the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. He came during that time, the Rif, and when he came, that's it, Spain became the leading center for Torah learning. Torah learning now became centered in it's going to be centered in France with Rashi and the Tosafos, and in Spain, starting with the Rif. I mentioned also one of the four captives. We made a mention that in the 960s also there were four captives, and one was sent to Egypt, one to North Africa, who was the father of Rabbeinu Hananel, who had a student, the Rif, who came to Spain, and there was also a Rav Moshe that came to Spain as well. So that all helped Spain become the major center of Torah. And it was during that time, most of the time, Spain was under the Muslims. But slowly but surely, I just may also make a mention, probably one of the greatest leaders that came out of Spain is the Rambam, 1135-1204. He came at a time when Muslims were coming in, a different type of Muslims who were very fanatic. Have we seen that before? And they were very, they weren't friendly to Jews that were there. So Jews started moving north to the Christians, who were more tolerant of the Jews and felt they needed Jews more. But many people, like the Rambam, instead fled from Spain. Eventually went to North Africa, and eventually he settled in Egypt, becoming the doctor for Saladin, who was the Muslim who fought Richard the Lionhearted. Like, this is full circle here. So he was, but that was, also came in Spain. He was learning from the Rebbe Magash, who was a Talmud of the Rif. If I got that right. Talmud of, yeah, I think so. The Rebbe Magash from the Rif. So the Rambam also had his learnings from the Rif. Eventually, the Christians throughout the years would push down and down and down, and by 1248, the Muslims were only in a very, very small part of Spain. As long as the Muslims were there, so then the Jews were able to exist in Spain. They were given positions of power. They were able to exist in society. It was a wealthy, very, very large established community. And this lasted from 1248, and it's going to last for over 100 years. It's going to be like that. As time is going on, the Jews are becoming more assimilated. They're becoming more Spanish. And just one other thing is 1260. So 1260, again, there was a Jew who became Christian, and Pablo Christianity felt that he would be able to prove the Jews the truth of Judaism, and that was the famous disputation in Barcelona with the Ramban. This is probably the only time that it was clear that the Jews won the debate. Clear from the Christians and the Jews, because after about a week of this, the Christians called off the debate. King James, who presided over it, first of all, he allowed the Ramban free speech to be able to say whatever he wanted, and he did. You know, all the other debates, Jews could only defend Judaism, but they could not speak against Christianity. Here, the Ramban was able to go on the attack. And after the debate, King James said about the Ramban, I never saw anybody defend something so wrong so well. So he gave him a lot of money. The Ramban
noble,
went...
The noble cause so nobly defended.
Right. What was that?
Pardon me?
So he said...
He never heard about an ignoble...
An ignoble
cause
so nobly defended.
So nobly defended.
Right. Okay. He gave him money.
I heard it from you last year.
Right, a noble, right. I forgot the exact Russian. So the Ramban, he was given money, and he went to the next day, that Shabbos and Shul, and said over the debate. He said over this is what I said. And the priest told the king, that's it. The Ramban only had permission to talk bad about Christianity during the debate, but this was after the debate, therefore kill him. King James was not ready to kill the Ramban, but he kicked him out of the country. So where did the Ramban go? He went to Eretz Yisrael. He made his way to Yerushalayim, did not find a minyan there. I mean, he's coming in 1260. This is after, this is way after the Crusades in 1180. The Muslims had taken Yerushalayim back. In the fourth Crusade, King Frederick had come and wreaked havoc there, wasn't able to keep Yerushalayim, but there was no Jews there, basically. And he got himself a minion from Jews from Shechem and Jews from Gaza and Hebron, and he put together a minion in Yerushalayim. And from that point on, I believe there was always a minion in Yerushalayim. This goes back from 1260 when the Ramban got there. Okay, the then came 1391, and this was the beginning of the end of Spanish Jewry. Who was a priest, Martinez, and basically he kept saying terrible things about the Jews, and there was the king in Castile passed away, and the priest, the cardinal passed away, and that's it. There was really no strong central government, and he was able to get a mob, and in Seville, where he started, he destroyed 23 shuls, confined the Jews to the ghetto, he removed Jews from power, and basically he gave Jews the choice, convert or die. And unfortunately, during this time, many Jews did not choose to die. And he went from Seville to Cordoba to Jaen, is that how you say it? Toledo. And then that was in Castile, and then it made its way into Aragon, Valencia, Majorca, these are different places, Barcelona, Girona, Catalonia. And at the end, this is... I hope it doesn't take you there. Just get out of this. But this is, we're looking over here, this is where it started. It started in Seville. And here's Seville, and the riots just kept going all over. At the end, the effects of the riot, 100,000 converted, 100,000 murdered, and somehow 100,000 somehow survived. And from this point on, the Jews were not in a good situation. At first still, there was a lot of pressure on the religious Jews, the Jews that did not convert. The Jews that converted, they weren't ready for such a conversion. They didn't have the outreach programs and teach them how to be a nice Christian and what to do and what not to do, the do's and the don'ts. And that's going to cause a different problem. After this, it brought another disputation in Torotosa, 1413. This time they learned from the mistakes of the Ramban, and they did not even allow the Jews to see the sources that they were quoting. The Jews believed that many of the sources were making up, you know, but that didn't. And at first, the Jews were very uncoordinated. They were being harassed, and it was just it was a debacle. Many Jews converted, and it was just terrible. It ended up very, very bad for the Jews. After 14. One thing that did come out of this is that they were asked 12 questions, and some of the most brilliant answers that we have recorded were given to these questions of faith, of religion, about Christianity and Judaism. I'm up to Germany now, but after this time, we didn't really touch the expulsion from Spain, but from 1413 to 1492, what's going to be is there's going to be a shift in the focus on the Jews that converted, and they're going to sort of leave the Jews that were not converted. They were a shadow of themselves. There weren't too many of them. The kings were not too happy, of course, because you can tax the Jews at a different rate than you can Christians. So for the kings, they were not having a good day on Wall Street on this. They took a big hit on this. But from this point on now, the Jews that were Muranos, so they were Muranos for a few, let's say three major categories. One that believed it and became Christians, that was one, let's put those aside. Then you had those that were doing it because they were just faking it, just outwardly, and they really wanted to become Jews, and they were just waiting for the right time to come back to Judaism. And there had been times in the past, even in Spain, under the Vikings, that they were forced to do this, and after a short amount of time, the Christians got tired of this, and they were able to come back. But this is not going to be. This time they were not going to. That's it. Once you're a Christian, you can't go back. And they're going to eventually bring in the Inquisition to the backsliding Jews. Some of them were really wanted to be Jews, and some of them just did not know what to do. They didn't know how to be a good Christian, you know. So, and that's all gonna, that the focus now towards the end is going to be on the converted Jews, and the Jews, they're not going, they're going to be a shadow of their of what they used to be. They're not going to have the power or prestige as they once were. You will have people at the end, even at the end, you had somebody like Don Isaac Abravanel, who was the finance minister to the King Ferdinand of Aragon, one of the most powerful positions. So he did have the Jews, the Jewish community was something, but it's not going to be anything of what they were. So coming into the 1400s, Spain is going to be inhospitable to Jews. It's just going to get worse till eventually their expulsion, which we'll talk about next year also in 1492. We just go to Germany, and Germany is also, we have the in the very beginning, again, it was Charlemagne. It was one big country, and Charlemagne invited the Jews to come in. It was a famous Colonimus family that came from Italy, and they settled, and they say that if not 90% of Ashkenazi Jewry, such a high percentage, all came from this Colonimus family. That all today, all Ashkenazi Jewry today, all came from this, mostly came from this large family. It was set up, the first great rabbi, the one who set the tone for Ashkenazi Jewry was Rabbeinu Gershom. We all know Rabbeinu Gershom, he made many, many takanos, but the four that we are very used to is that, one, you can't have more than one wife, and they were in Christian Europe. The Christians only had one wife, and they felt it was for many reasons, which we spoke a few years ago, that one wife for Ashkenazi Jewry, he put a 500-year time limit on it. He says, in 500 years, that's it, it expired. It was an expiration date. And if the rabbis in 500 years want to revisit this, they could. But of course they didn't. And here we are today, one wife for Ashkenazim. Also, the wives have to agree to a divorce. Also, we also know, Cherim de Rabbeinu Gershom, reading somebody else's mail. Also forbid Jews to remind the Jews, forced to convert to Christianity. You see, even Rabbeinu Gershom, he had a son that was forcibly converted to Christianity, which he mourned all his life. And that's something, these are different things, many, many more that Rabbeinu Gershom. So he was like the beginning. Things were pretty good for the Jews there. They felt very comfortable there up until the First Crusade. When the First Crusade happened, it destroyed the German community. Speyer, Vermont, Mayence, these were three, four major German countries, and two or three of them were totally destroyed by the mobs. As they kept going west towards the Holy Land, they kept destroying Jewish places. What the Crusades did, the psyche or the understanding is that it taught the Europeans that you can organize and you can kill Jews, basically. It was a new mindset. Up until then, it was never heard of. The Jews were part and parcel of the community, of the society. But now things were different, and now the Jews could be killed. Just a new way of looking at the Jews.
Was that the whole goal of the Crusades, was to kill Jews?
No. They had a lot of things. I think I spent about 3-4 times up here. One goal was to free the Holy Land. Another goal was to get these soldiers that did not have any enemies to a place where they could fight enemies and not pick on people, regular people. They had to do something with these standing armies and do something with them. There was also a shortage of land going around to barons and knights. So they figured, let's expand. They wanted to bring in the Byzantine church under them as well, because they got the call from them that the Turks were threatening. So the Pope Benedict said, wow, look at this. We could, you know, with one full swoop, we can do a lot. And the rabble said, why do we have to go all the way to the Holy Land to fight the infidel? We have Jews among us here. And that's how that happened. The knights that were disciplined, you know, that was a standing army, the knights. So they weren't in the main attacking Jews. But the people, they were also inspired. They were given Olam Haba and indulgences and, you know, a religious war. You could promise a lot of things to a lot of people. And so they were also interested to better their life, too. Their life was not too productive, and there was no upward mobility. And for them, why not? They had nothing to lose. So, okay. This is a great tragedy. I'm just then moving forward. So the difference between German and France and England is that Germany was never united. They're not going to be united up until the 1800s under Bismarck. And they were a collection of over like 300 different city-states. Some of them were a conglomerate of all these different city-states. And what the rules were in one wasn't necessarily rule in the other. They had like, I think, 9 electorates, 9 major places. But they were always, you know, very small and fragmented. So even though you were expelled from one of the cities, the Jews were able to move to another city. The major event that happened of its time is the mayor of Rottenburg, who was the leader of his time. He was leaving Germany. Why he was leaving is not 100% clear, but he was recognized in Italy. And I guess it was a crime. What exactly the crime is also not clear, but the crime is the king felt that the Jews belonged to him, and how the nerve of you to leave. But this was a way for the king to get money, and he put him in jail and ransomed him for a crazy, crazy amount of money. The rush, his students started working on redeeming him. But as we'll see in a minute, there was the Rindfleisch massacres and other things, and they just didn't have the German community at the time just couldn't put together the money. So he died in jail. The rush soon after left to Spain, which again this is in the 1293. This is which was an infusion. It helped the Spanish community in terms of being more frum. It brought the European learning to Spain. He refused to be ransomed. We spoke about this, his indications that he did want to be ransomed, but they just couldn't get the money. 1296, then you had the Rindfleisch. He was a German knight. There was some blood libel, and he just took it upon himself to kill Jews, convert them all or kill them. And hundreds of thousands, you're talking tens of thousands, I'm sorry, 146 communities in southern and central Germany, Austria, were destroyed by Rindfleisch. By the time he was done, there was also Germany was a shadow of himself, of itself. He believed that he had something from heaven to do it. When was this happening? The monarch of the time, I forgot the king, who was the king at the time, he was trying to consolidate his power. The electorates didn't, the king died, and the son of the king, they didn't want to elect the son because they didn't want it to become the Holy Roman Emperor, they didn't want it to be hereditary. So they gave it to somebody else who was not a good emperor, and the other king had to fight his way to become back. And while this was happening, and there's no strong government, so then that's it. That's what happens. People are allowed to do what they do. It seems that they say as many as 100,000 Jews were killed, and so now. This is all besides smaller expulsions. But they say in the end of the 1500s, this is at least what I have, in Germany, this was about what was left. Frankfurt on the Main had about 2,000 Jews, Worms 1,400, Prague 10,000, Vienna 3,000. That's about what would be left of just after expulsion and after massacre and expulsion in Germany. So now Germany, you're looking at a very, very small community in Germany also. Just an example of these are all different places that the Jews were expelled. Wales, this is Wales, I don't know about Scotland. Wales in 1290, England 1290, France 1182, 1306, 1391, and 1394. Provence, South France will eventually be 1430, Spain 1492. So in the 1300s, Germany 1348, this is with the Black Plague. I didn't even mention the Black Plague with all the expulsions. Evidently, as you can see, the Jews are going to be starting to move east. They're going to move to Poland. They're going to move to the Ottoman Empire, the Turks. Different cities, Italy, Mainz, France, 1182, Bavaria, England, 1290, France, 1306, France again, 1322, Switzerland, 1348, these in 1349, Hungary, 1360, Slovakia, 1380, Strasbourg, 1388, Germany, 1394, that's with the Rheinfleisch, France again, 1394. So again, the end of the 1300s, Western Europe, pretty much does not have any Jews. Spain is, in terms of from Jews, just nothing that much. Again, another expulsion. Okay, from the 1000 to 1500, in these 500 years, it's estimated about 380,000 Jews were killed, reducing the total number of Jews in the world to about 1 million. 16th, 17th century, main center of Jewish population were in Poland and the Mediterranean countries. And that's really what we're going to be picking up. The future. Future is going to be Poland, and there's going to be, again, a solid 200, 250 years, which is going to be expanding. They're going to want Jews to come. The Jews are going to have a tremendous amount of autonomy. They're going to have their own government, the Arba, Bad Arba, Arzos. They're going to have a four lands. They're going to have fairs. They're going to be able to get to see each other. The Ottoman Empire, the Turks, are going to make for themselves a massive empire, and they're going to invite the Jews. The only problem is from Spain to get to the Turkish area, especially Istanbul. They're going to open up conquer Byzantine. They're going to open it up for the Jews to come and fill in the places. The Jews that can make it there are going to do very well. It's just that we'll see. The Jews were not so fortunate. Most of the Jews ended up going to Portugal, and 5 years later they had to have been expelled again. But they weren't expelled. They weren't allowed to leave. Just tragic what's going to be to the Spanish Jews. But the Turkish Empire, again, the first 200 years is going to be very good for the Jews. And there's going to be the Eretz Yisrael spot is going to make a big comeback. There's going to be a small window there that the greatest are going to be there. Rabbi Yosef Cairo, the Arizal, the Ramak, just a small concentration of the greatest minds. And that's what I guess next year, Mitzvah Hashem, will be picking it up. The world is going to be different.
Why is it they were there? It's a small town, and so why is that on the map versus another city?
Oh, I don't know. I just picked up a map somewhere, map. I just picked up something that said Sfat or Safed. I just wanted just to focus. That's what I wanted. Whatever else was on the map, I didn't clean it up.
Really says safe.
Huh?
Safe.
Oh,
safe.
Oh, yeah, they're saved. Saved. Very nice. The world is going to be different because through the 13th centuries, with all the millions and tens of millions of people that have been killed through the Hundred Years' War, through the plague, the Black Plague and everything, so with all the Christian church is on the way down and the temporal leaders are on the way up, it's going to be a different world. The church and that different world is going to be a new world that the Jews are going to be living in. And it's going to be what they're going to call the late Middle Ages up until the modern age. So thank you all for coming.
It's been my pleasure.
I learned so much this year. I hope you did too. And Amir Sashem, we'll see you all next year.
So, Rabbi